I would like to notify all parties that the call today is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to the Charm Telecon for September 2006. We have a terrific topic today, a very, very nice follow-on to last month's presentation, which was all about Titan Surface. The presentation today by Dr. Hunter Waite, who is the team leader for the ion and neutral mass spectrometer, will be telling us all about Titan's atmosphere. And with that, I'll let you take it away, Dr. Waite.
All right. Thanks, Trina. Today we're going to talk about Titan in the way that it produces organic molecules. As you probably know from last week, Titan's got a thick N2 atmosphere, like a molecular nitrogen atmosphere like that of the Earth, with a little bit of methane. Methane is important because methane provides the feedstock, so to speak, of the organic chemistry that takes place. In the case of Earth, Earth has a little bit of methane as well, but methane is pretty small in terms of concentration in the atmosphere, in Earth's atmosphere, perhaps larger in past times, though. And that source of methane comes from biology. So this is all to explain the title. The solar system's abiotic petroleum factory. Methane comes about not by the process of biology on Titan, but by the process of original materials that were incorporated into the material of the moon itself. And the chemistry that takes place, we'll describe in great detail, takes place in the upper atmosphere and leads to consequences, global consequences at Titan. So if we go on to the second slide, I've been through a few. Let me go back up. Yes, a question? Okay. I'll go back over the motivations for the Titan studies. Titan's atmosphere is similar to Earth's early atmosphere. For the rise of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, oxygen came.
You know, Hunter, I'll go off to the operator to see if I can track down the noise on the line.
Okay. Earth came about from life, from life on the Earth, and that happened about 2.5 billion years ago. And before that time, the Earth was not such an oxidizing environment. In fact, there may have been quite a bit of methane in the atmosphere. And in that earlier time period, there's evidence that there may have been times where the Earth had produced organic smog in a natural way, much like Titan does in the present day. Titan is enshrouded in clouds, so if you look in visible light, you don't see the surface. You just see the upper atmosphere. It's just all organic smog, and we'll talk more about this in a bit. As far as Titan may help us understand the origin of life in the solar system, organic molecules are a very important part of the ingredients for producing life, at least as life in the way we know it on Earth. Amino acids are important for building proteins, as you know, and all of the compounds that are important in life come about through organic chemistry. And so we can produce the precursors of these compounds by natural processes in the upper atmosphere of Titan, so that can help us understand the organic chemistry that had to go on before life began. And Titan may help us unlock the mysteries of organic formation in other regions of our galaxy and universe. Some of the same chemistry that we're going to talk about today takes place in interstellar clouds as well. And so they're producing organic compounds, much like Titan is, that could be precursors to biology. If you go on to slide 3, I've got four panels here. They represent different ways in which Cassini-Huygens provides measurements at Titan. And I'll go briefly through each of those. The satellite itself represents what we call in situ instrumentation, instruments that are strapped to the spacecraft that measure the local environment. And in particular, we're going to talk about mass spectrometry in that regard today as an important way of obtaining information about composition. The the panel in the upper right represents remote sensing. This is a picture in the near infrareds where we're looking down through the clouds to the surface at Titan. And we can obtain both spectra and images in this way to understand the surface of Titan and also the composition of the atmosphere as well. So we'll talk about those types of measurements. The bottom left shows an artist's rendition of the probe on the surface of Titan. And the probe, you've heard about, I'm sure, from probably last week. Huygens probe was provided by the Europeans and landed on the surface of Titan in January of 2005 and provided some very important information that we'll discuss briefly. And finally, another way of remote sensing is radar mapping, and I'm sure that was discussed fairly extensively last week. But we turn this big antenna towards Titan, and we can take a look at below. We can penetrate through the clouds and get information about the surface in the highest resolution that Cassini can provide. I think the most important thing about this slide is that Cassini is a very, very well-equipped laboratory, and it's all of these instruments working together that help us build up this picture and understanding of what Titan is all about. It's not just one instrument. We go on to the next panel. In situ instrumentation, as I said, are things that detect energetic particles, things that measure the composition of dust, instruments that measure the composition of the gases, and instruments that measure the local radio waves and plasma waves that surround the spacecraft. But the point being, it's in situ. It's things near the spacecraft that are being measured. The thing we're going to concentrate on today is in the fifth slide, this is one animation that you can see where you get gas molecules coming in on the left side, and they go through this ionization source region, and they're bombarded with electrons and ionized. And once they're ionized, then they pass through this mass analyzer, which filters them according to their to mass, and then they're detected on the green panel in the back. To give you an idea of what a spectrum looks like, go on to slide 6, and you can see a spectrum of carbon dioxide. And you can see that you not only form through electron bombardment the carbon dioxide ion CO2 plus at mass 44, but you also, the electrons can also break it apart so that you can form CO plus, O plus, and C plus. So these things taken together in certain, and the ratios represented in this graph are a fingerprint of this of CO2 and the coming into the mass spectrometer. So there's a whole lot of different molecules. The spectrum gets quite complicated, as we'll see a little bit later, but this is the way we can deconvolve and understand what the spectra are telling us about the composition. That's for neutrals. For ions, they're already ionized, and I'll go into that in just a few minutes. Okay, back to this panel. The second thing we're going to talk about are remote observations. This first, if you go on to slide 8, you can see, and it's actually animated, but it doesn't come across in the PDF file. You're getting closer. This is taken by the ISS camera as we move in the near infrared as we move towards Titan on one of the early flybys. And the dark regions and the bright regions represent different types of surface composition on Titan. So you're seeing below the clouds because you're looking in the near infrared. If you were looking in the visible, you wouldn't see the surface because it's shrouded by this chemical smog that we're going to discuss. In figure 9, this is a figure that does have an animation. The animation is this little molecule of formaldehyde that's represented by the the turquoise, red, and gray. Carbon is gray. Oxygen is red, and the hydrogens are blue. And the important point at the top is that Cassini can look at many, many wavelengths. So we can look at ultraviolet light, We can look at visible light. We can look at infrared light. We can also look at radio wavelengths, which is not represented here, and that's what we are looking at when we're looking at when we're looking at longer wavelengths. That's what is used by the radar for the surface. In that case, it's centimeter wavelengths. The important thing, though, about this particular figure is that in the infrared, much like in the case of the mass spectra, the different ways in which the molecule wiggles, vibrates, and rotates make a series of fingerprints at certain wavelengths in the infrared, and those ratios of those lines are used in the same way we do mass spectrometry as a fingerprint that we're looking at formaldehyde. So we see all these different spectral features. These are absorptions in this particular case. So those absorptions at different wavelengths are indicative of us of the composition of the atmosphere. So we're going to use this information, the spectral information in the infrared, in today's presentation as well. Back to our original figure, the next thing to talk about is the probe. So on slide 11, there's a little animation that shows the probe descending on parachutes in the last few meters. This is an animation, of course. And actually taking data, not only as it moved through the atmosphere, but on the surface after it landed as well. And we'll talk about that. Now, finally, back to this original figure in slide 12, we're going to talk about radar and how radar obtains data. This is the one time in slide 13 where you'll see a blank unless you have the animation. The animation shows the spacecraft flying by Titan, turning its big antenna in the direction of Titan, and sending down a beam of radiation that's scattered off the surface back up to the radar antenna, detected, and tells us about the surface. If it turns out to be bright in the radar image, then that's telling us that the surface is rough. It's scattering light electromagnetic radiation back at us in this wavelength region in all directions, and we see it, and it turns out bright. If it's a very smooth surface, it'll turn out to be radar dark. And I know that this is repeated from what Larry told you about last week, but I'm going to show a couple of radar images to put things in perspective, and I just wanted to explain that as well. Okay, so finally in 14, we come to what I think is the central focus of understanding organic chemistry on the surface of Titan, and that's the methane cycle. And there's two aspects of this methane cycle that I want to point out to you. One of them is a short-term cycle that I think was discussed fairly extensively by Larry last week, which has to do with methane venting out of volcanoes evaporating from lakes and going up into the atmosphere, forming clouds, and then finally precipitating back to form lakes. So it's a hydrological cycle that's much like the cycle for water on the Earth. And the reason this takes place on Titan is that in the case of the Earth, water, the temperature and pressure of the Earth are such that water is at its triple point. Water can exist as a gas, as a liquid, and as a solid. Okay? The important thing at Titan, it's much, much colder. The surface is 93 degrees Kelvin, but methane can exist in all three forms. It can exist as a gas, a liquid, or a solid. So the methane cycle in that regard is much like the water cycle on the Earth. That's a short-term cycle. That takes months, days, months, years kind of time period. Another important cycle which we're going to concentrate on today is another cycle that takes on the order of millions of years to really cycle through, and that's release of methane into the upper atmosphere. And if you can look up there, we got a on the right-hand upper corner, you see sunlight and energetic particles coming in and hitting N2 and CH4. That causes this organic chemistry in the upper atmosphere. Yes, is there a question? Okay. Some of it forms condensate haze. Some of it stays in the gaseous form. The part that forms the condensate haze probably ends up precipitating on the surface and forming these organic dunes that I think probably Larry spoke about last weekend. And this is a much longer cycle, and I'm going to describe this in a little bit more detail. I'll go through both of them kind of briefly for your benefit in a couple of slides here. So let's go on to slide 15. This is a slide that tells us a little bit about the interior, and this is actually borrowed from Larry, so I would imagine that this is a repeat for you. There's a rocky core, but there's layers of liquid water ice surrounding that, and liquid and water ice. So there are layers of ices and liquids, and in within this material, there's both ammonia and there's methane that are trapped in the ices, and over time, they seep out of the crust, either in a volcanic way or in other cracks through the surface, and ammonia and methane are incorporated into the atmosphere in this way. So something like what we call cryovolcanism is probably the main source of of methane in the atmosphere that starts the process. And this is the next picture, slide 16, is a infrared image of a cryovolcano. You can see the blow up shows this kind of snail-like looking feature, which are just layers of material, or thought to be layers of material that have seeped out of this cryovolcano. And so the material that you actually see is ammonia ice, but with that came methane that was outgassed into the atmosphere as well. And just to complete this process, of course, it goes up and is incorporated. And in figure 17, though, you see a recent image, a radar image of the surface, where there's a series of lakes at high latitude. This is an indication of those lakes. The dark features are thought to be the lakes. Dark, as I remind you, means it's a very smooth surface, and the brighter regions are rougher surfaces. So you can see the darkest features they've seen on Titan, which are highly suggestive of liquid methane in lakes at high latitudes. Okay, so that explains that. We go back to slide 18. That kind of gives you a very brief overview of what you heard probably a lot about last week, which is the hydrological cycle of methane on the surface. Today we're going to concentrate on the other process. The amount of methane that's outgassed into the upper atmosphere, methane is broken apart, as we're going to talk about, by sunlight and energetic particles, and converted into these more complex hydrocarbons and nitrile compounds, which then precipitate onto the surface. But when it breaks apart, the hydrogen escapes, and I'll tell you about that a little bit more in a minute. And when it does, that you can't reform the methane because there's not enough hydrogen around. And so methane is converted into higher order hydrocarbons, more complex compounds. And over about 50 million years, the amount of methane that's in the atmosphere completely disappears unless you keep resupplying it. So that's why I say this is a cycle that takes tens of millions of years to complete. If you were to shut off the methane, all of it would disappear through this cycle in about 50 million years. Okay, if we go on to the next figure, this is the crux of what we're going to cover today in some detail. This is a pretty complicated slide 19, where we show mass spectra in the upper atmosphere for both the ions and the neutrals. And we're going to come back and understand this in some detail. but you notice that going up to masses of, let's say, 100 Daltons, and Daltons is just just atomic mass units divided by the charge on the species. So most molecules that are detected are singly charged. So it would be a mass of 100 AMU is the upper range of the ion neutral mass spectrometer that we're concentrating on today. And you can see the complexity of these compounds. These compounds are being built, and they extend right out of our mass range. You see very complex species like benzene, B6H6, at mass 78. Very complex compounds that are being formed in both the ion chemistry and the neutral chemistry, and they're coupled together. And I'm going to discuss this in gory detail in a bit. So let's go on from that. I did mention before, and I'll mention again, that some of this same type of chemistry is thought to take place in interstellar clouds. And this is just a slide that shows some of the types of compounds that have been seen in spectra of interstellar clouds. Compounds that seem to be quite similar in most respects to that what we see in the upper atmosphere. With one exception, there's more oxygen available in these interstellar clouds than there is in Titan's upper atmosphere. So some of the oxygen-bearing compounds are depleted in Titan with respect to what we see in interstellar clouds. But these are important building blocks to form things like amino acids and proteins, and you can see an indication of RNA and genetic material here, but those are biological processes. What we're talking about today are the precursor organic molecules. We're not talking about life. If you go on to slide 21, this is now a measurement not taken now in the upper atmosphere, as I showed you before, but this is taken in the middle atmosphere, in that region where these aerosols are forming, this smog that surrounds Titan. And there's two pieces of information here on that region of the atmosphere. One, we call it the stratosphere, and there's both gas and particulates in the stratosphere. The particulates are the smog. The probe determine the composition of the smog to some degree through pyrolysis, a burning process. And in the upper panel on the right-hand side, you can see the mass spectra in the mass spectrometer of the constituents that were measured, are the constituents that make up these particulates. And you can see they're the same building blocks that we see in the upper atmosphere. So we know that these things are made of organic materials, hydrocarbons and nitrile compounds. And we also see in the lower spectrum, this is an infrared spectrum, showing a whole host of different species of hydrocarbons in the stratosphere. It's kind of hard to read, but you can see C2H, you can see ethane, methane, you can see ethylene, acetylene, perhaps not in this particular spectrum, but you can see benzene. So all these compounds we see at higher altitudes are seen in the stratosphere, but at much lower concentrations. So what this tells us is that this chemistry is starting in the upper atmosphere and continuing in the lower atmosphere, but part of the process involves forming aerosol compounds, and part of the process is the continuation of the gas phase chemistry that's taking place. Okay, and the consequence is finally that some of this particulate material, then if you go to slide 22, forms particles that precipitate onto the surface. And what the radar people have been telling us, if you look at the upper image in this particular slide, is that these dunes that they've seen in the radar, these little black lines that you're seeing, are dunes. They're fairly they're about 100 meters high. They're very large dunes, and the patterns are formed by the prevailing wind patterns on Titan. Much like in the lower slides, you see the Arabian Desert has similar types of patterns, and the Namib Desert has similar types of patterns. Again, these are prevailing wind patterns, but this is silicon material on Earth that forms these desert dunes, whereas in Titan, we think that the material that's incorporated in these dunes is organic material, so it was supplied by being produced in the upper atmosphere. Okay, and then finally, to just help understand why we think that this material is organic and that there's quite a bit of organic material on the surface, you'll go on to slide 23. We show the descent sequence of the Huygens probe. And the probe landed, when it did land on the surface, it was never designed to actually land, but it did land and it continued to take measurements, and that was fortunate, because if you go into slide 24, you see a spectrum, and now another mass spectrum. So this is M over Z, or mass over charge, and a signal, and you see quite a few species that we saw in the upper atmosphere that we've identified in the upper atmosphere. We see molecular nitrogen that I told you about as the key constituent, methane, which is about 2% in terms of its relative composition to molecular nitrogen. We see molecular hydrogen, but we also see ethane, C2H6. We see some CO2. We see some C2N2, and we see C6H6, which is benzene. But these weren't seen just in the atmosphere. A couple of these compounds, the organics, the C2N2 and the C2H6 and the benzene, were seen only after the probe had sat on the surface and warmed the surface. The surface is at 93 degrees Kelvin, and the probe was about room temperature. So the probe was warming the surface, and as it warmed the surface, these things were in some kind of icy form on the surface, some kind of solid form, and they were vaporized and subsequently measured by the probe. So that's the reason that we think that a lot of this material on the surface is made up of organic compounds. Okay, so we've kind of gone through the methane cycle, at least the two cycles, as an overview of the science. If you go on to slide 26, I'm going to start talking about the details of the ion neutral mass spectrometer, but I think this might be a good point to stop for a minute and to let people ask a few questions so that you make sure that you understand what we talked about in the first part so that the second part makes more sense.
Yes, I have a question to ask. Harold Kozak, Solar System Ambassador from Staten Island, New York.
Uh-huh.
I was very interested in what you were saying before about the fact that a lot of the organic precursor molecules are similar to in structure to amino acids and RNA.
I didn't say RNA. I'm just that's going a little too far. They're close. They may be close in structure to amino acids, but that's about as complicated as we've been able to measure yet.
Well, I'm just curious about something now, because for many, many years, I teach astronomy at Wagner College here on Staten Island. I've mentioned to students the possibility, even though it's kind of remote because it goes back to the days of Carl Sagan's Cosmos, of possibly in the future NASA might be thinking about seeding Titan with some sort of anaerobic microbes. Based on what you're saying here with the temperature, the organic molecules, I'm just curious, do you think that might be more feasible now in light of the evidence that you're presenting here today?
Well, the difficulty with life on Titan is the temperature, and the fact that any water that's present is in completely frozen form, and we don't know any life forms that operate at that kind of temperature extreme. That doesn't mean they don't exist, but any kind of life forms that we would take there as a seed population would never be able to exist at the cold temperatures of Titan's surface. So although there's a lot of organic material for it to use as food, so to speak, there's no liquid water to help the processes metabolic processes occur.
Well, you're saying that the surface temperatures would be a limiting factor then. What about the fact that there possibly might be a liquid water or liquid ammonia below the surface?
Well, that's a different, yes. In that particular case, if indeed there is a liquid water layer because of the increased temperature closer to the center of the body, then there's a possibility that some of that organic material could be used as feedstock for some kind of life form. So that cannot be ruled out if we find liquid water beneath the surface. But we don't have any strong evidence for that yet. All we have is theoretical models that suggest that might be the case.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Any other questions about the what we're talking about so far before I go on? Okay, so I'm going to get into the details. Just to put this in perspective, the idea that the organic chemistry that's important for producing all these constituents that we see ending up on the surface of the planet takes place in the upper atmosphere helps or suggests that we should focus on the measurements from the ion neutral mass spectrometer in the upper atmosphere to try to understand what that chemistry is, what compounds are formed, and to get an idea of how the solar system is working as a chemical factory to produce these organic molecules. So now we're going to get into the details of the ion neutral mass spectrometer in a bit more detail. So if you go on to slide 27, this is a slide that just shows relative to Titan a couple of different views of where some of the key orbits that have been important for the mass spectrometer have passed with regard to Titan. Some of them have, the point being, we pass by at different latitudes, we pass by at different altitudes. The lower altitudes go deeper into the atmosphere, and the atmosphere pressure increases exponentially. So low altitude passes are important for us, but covering different regions of the surface are equally important. So we want multiple flybys to try to characterize what's going on. If we go on to slide 28, this shows you a cartoon of the inside of the mass spectrometer that we're going to talk about. So we got neutral gas coming in the upper portion into this antechamber at 6 kilometers per second, because the spacecraft is traveling at 6 kilometers per second, which is pretty fast with regard to Titan. And that atmosphere is then forced into this antechamber through this transfer tube. As in our picture, these electrons are fired at it, it's turned into ions, and then it's pulled down into the quad, what we see is the quad lens, and then on into the mass spectrometer, the mass analyzer below that. So all the neutral measurements we make have been made with this thing we call the closed source, which is this upper loop that I just described. The lower loop says neutral gas or positive ions. Well, in this case, we're going to talk, the positive ions are the one we're going to concentrate on today, coming in through this source. So it passes through a series of lenses. The electron guns are turned off because we're measuring ions. They're already ionized materials. The quad lens turns the particle 90 degrees into the mass analyzer, and so the same mass analyzer detects these particles. And we switch back and forth between these two as we fly through the upper atmosphere. And we switch back and forth. We take mass spectra every 2.3 seconds. So it's a pretty fast, and we get 68 measurements in that time. Pretty fast series of measurements that we make going through the upper atmosphere. If you go on to slide 29, this is a kind of complicated display of what we see. Time is progressing as you go from left to right, okay? And the mass spectra are laid down next to each other as we go across, and the intensity tells you how much we measured at a given mass. So the y-axis of this figure is mass per charge that I've shown you before. The x-axis is time. And you can see right in the center, things get the brightest, and you see the most material, and that's where we're at the closest approach to Titan. When we go deepest into the atmosphere, we get the maximum signal. And you can see the important friends that we talked about before, N2, which is molecular nitrogen, CH4, which is methane, and H2, which is molecular hydrogen. Those are the brighter traces. But we see constituents at other masses too. We see complicated organic molecules, including benzene in this upper trace. I'll come back to this. So, if you take a slice of this at a certain time, a certain value of the x-axis, you see what you see in figure on slide 30. In slide 30, I show a spectrum of the ions that we talked about coming in, and the neutral gases. These were taken within the 2 or 3 seconds of each other. But you can see now the x-axis is mass per charge, and the y-axis is the number of counts, or the concentration of the species, the density. And you can see that throughout that spectrum, all the way up to 100 atomic mass units, that there's plenty of material. So and the spacing, one of the important things to note is there's kind of in the turquoise, when there's kind of every 12 atomic mass units, there's a different series of peaks. And that's not an accident, because that's about what it takes. 12 to 14 mass units is what is added every time you add on a carbon or a nitrogen. And that's what's being added to these things to make the more complex molecules. And that pattern is more evident in the ions, is repeated and has a correspondence in peaks that we see in the neutral material as well, the red. Okay? Going on to 31. 31 is now showing you a different way of viewing this. We've taken a certain fingerprint for a certain series of mass peaks for, say, nitrogen or methane or hydrogen, and now we plotted it versus time, and at different times we're at different altitudes, so we can get altitude profiles. So this shows us density on the y-axis versus altitude as we go down deeper into the atmosphere, and it's plotted on a log scale, so you can see that there's an exponential increase in the density of the atmosphere the deeper we go in the atmosphere. This is true on Earth as well. So we see, and the difference in the lines, the width of the lines, shows you the variability in the upper atmosphere of Titan. These are several different passes, TA, T5, T16, these are things that people in Cassini know quite well, but they're just different flyby opportunities. And you can see there's quite a bit of variation from one pass to the next that has to do with the variability of the upper atmosphere of Titan, something that was a bit surprising. We didn't expect it to have so much variation, but it does. Going on to slide 32, we've repeated this same type of process where we show density versus altitude, but now for more complex compounds, such as acetylene, ethylene, ethane. So acetylene is the dark blue. This kind of magenta is the ethylene. Ethane is the turquoise-looking color. Propene is the red color. And acetylene polymer, C4H2, is the gray. And then benzene, the C6H6, are the open white squares. So these are now allowing us to look at the altitude variations of very complex species as well as the minor constituents. Now densities in 32 are quite hard to determine. So these are approximate densities. It's difficult to tell the difference between acetylene, ethylene, and ethane, for example. So whether we have exactly the right ratios there is not the point. The point is we can make the measurements and determine the altitude. Okay, so now that's an introduction to the type of data that INMS requires when it goes through the upper atmosphere. Now let's talk about what the relevance of the INMS observations are to the overall understanding of the upper atmosphere. And feel free to stop me with questions at any time. So on slide 33, I list at least two major bullets of the relevance of the observations, and I'll go through these in a bit of detail. One is about the information about the evolution of the atmosphere of Titan. Excuse me, my computer's talking to me. So the evolution of the upper atmosphere, and that has to do with what we can learn about the outgassing of the interior and the escape of gases from Titan is another important point. And then we'll spend a fair amount of time talking about the production of organic compounds, the ion-neutral photochemistry, and the role of the magnetosphere, the magnetic sphere that emanates from Saturn that encompasses Titan during most of its orbit. Okay, so going on to slide 34, we get another look at a mass spectrum, and I point out two important features that we've measured the concentration of. One is the mass 40 isotope of argon, which comes from radioactive decay of potassium, and also the mass 36 isotope of argon, which is a primordial constituent. It's a stable isotope. So the case of in both of these cases, these can tell us give us different types of information. The argon 40 tells us how much of the volatile material has been outgassed from the interior. And by looking at the concentration of argon 40 in the atmosphere and calculating or estimating how much potassium there should be in the interior in minerals and how much argon 40 should have been formed over geological time, then we can get an idea of the degree with which the interior is outgassed. And estimates vary, but between 2 and, let's say, 15% are the estimates. The variation doesn't have to do with the measurement of argon 40 because the mass spectrometer that landed on the surface agrees with what we see. The uncertainty has to do with how much original potassium was included in the planet or in the body when it was established. So it tells us that there are plenty more volatiles that are trapped in the interior, and in that sense, some of them may be tied up in these liquid oceans that were mentioned earlier. So there's quite a bit of volatile material that could escape if things were heated up. The argon 36 tells us another piece of information. It tells us about the form in which nitrogen comes about in this atmosphere. It turns out that since nitrogen is a very volatile material, that if it's to be trapped as a nitrogen molecule, it has to be trapped in an ice cage. We call it a clathrate. And ice cages that trap nitrogen would also trap argon 36 in their formation in the very cold region of the protosolar nebula. So by looking at argon 36, we can tell how much N2 was brought in as molecular nitrogen, and we find that it's not much. So we think that most of the nitrogen from Titan came in as ammonia and then was converted from ammonia into molecular nitrogen by photochemistry in the atmosphere. So those are two important pieces of information about what's going on in the atmosphere that can be determined from isotopic measurements. Now, going on to slide 35, we get another idea of how isotopic measurements, stable isotopes, in this case of nitrogen and of carbon, are important in understanding the atmosphere. These this can, particularly in the case of nitrogen, so we can measure then, I've got 14N written, and I show you the peak, and that the 14 isotope is normal isotope of nitrogen, and the less abundant isotope is the 15 isotope. So 14N is just regular molecular nitrogen, and 15N is an molecular nitrogen with a mass 15 nitrogen incorporated into it. And by measuring the ratio of those two, we can get some idea of how much material has escaped over geological time. I'm going to come back to this in just a minute. And we can also get similar information from the mass from the carbon 13 to carbon 12 ratio. Now, this measurement, isotopic measurement, is an important indicator of life if you measure it very carefully on Earth. There's no indication, though, that there's no isotopic evidence for life on Titan if you look close to the surface. But if you do look at this, you can tell this ratio, you can tell something about the escape and the resupply of methane in the upper atmosphere. Okay, so let's go on to slide 36 and try to understand how you use those measurements. Okay, so in 36, I show isotopic ratio of N14 to N15 as a function of altitude. So on the x-axis is altitude, starting off at 1,000, going up to about 1,600 kilometers. And on the y-axis is the ratio of 14 to 15. So as that increases, the amount of light nitrogen, 14, increases. And the different colors represent the different flybys. So it's a lot of data, and you see that same kind of characteristic change. And what you see is that it starts off, 14 to 15 start off around 155 in the lower atmosphere, and then because they are different masses, the atmosphere is not well mixed up at that point. It's not turbulent mixing, stirring it up. It starts separating out by mass. And as you get to the top of the atmosphere, which is represented by about 1,500 kilometers, you can see that 14 has become the more predominant constituent than 15. And this has to do with just gravitational separation of the two diffusion processes. Well, what that indicates, though, is that since 14 is more prevalent than 15 in the upper atmosphere, the nitrogen that escapes from the upper atmosphere is predominantly mass 14. So over geological time, more of the mass 14 escapes than the mass 15. All right? So that then allows us to use this information to make inferences about how much of the atmosphere has been lost over time. And let's see. Okay. I'm trying to find the right slide for that. Okay, the next slide, 37, shows us the same pattern for 12 to 13, that same separation process that has to do with gravity and molecular diffusion in the upper atmosphere, so that the lighter constituent is favored to the upper atmosphere relative to the heavier constituent. Now, the traces that look kind of funny, like the turquoise and the red, go the wrong direction. Ignore those, because there's a completely different explanation for that, and that is that since the mass spectrometer is very sensitive, that has to do with contamination of the thrusters that are keeping the spacecraft pointing in the right direction as we go through the atmosphere. So here we're seeing our own exhaust gases, and that's contaminating the observations on the outbound portion of these flybys. I left them on there for completeness, but that's why they don't follow the right path. All right, if we go on to slide 38, then here's another way that we can study escape with INMS, and we show the nitrogen and the methane, and we show its altitude distribution, and we fit temperature curves to it. And what we see is that if you just assume that it stays the same temperature, in which it should, then there's more material at high altitudes above the atmosphere, above where collisions are taking place, in what we call the exosphere. There's more N2 and there's more methane present than there should be. So there should be, meaning that would normally be if it was all at the same temperature. So what it means is that at the very upper reaches of the atmosphere, both nitrogen and methane have been heated. And when they're heated, that means they've been given energy, and that energy allows the molecules to escape. All right, so we have escape of nitrogen occurring in the upper atmosphere as a result of the heating of the upper atmosphere, and that heating comes about from particles sputtering, hitting the upper atmosphere, particles from the magnetosphere hitting the upper atmosphere, moving very fast, heating that material up and causing some of it to escape to space. All right, coming back to slide 39, then, we can estimate from looking at that the escape rates that we would infer from direct measurements of the upper atmosphere. And unfortunately, we find out that column, it was highlighted on the PowerPoint, but it lost it in this slide set. If you look at column 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's something called phi ESC. That's phi escape. And those numbers then are indicative of what we infer from the escape process. That escape that we measure directly does not seem to match what we need to determine the isotopic ratio. So if you go on to 40, let's talk about that for just a second. Here we have quite a bit of information. It's a little bit hard to read because the font color is a bit off, but you can see that the values for the isotopic ratio of 14 to 15 in the lower part of the atmosphere are 155, and the terrestrial reference is 215. That means that over 70% of the atmosphere, the inference would be that over 70% of the atmosphere has escaped. That's from looking at the nitrogen. If that has happened over geological time, the escape flux that we actually see happening is 10,000 times too small to explain the escape. So we don't fully understand the escape processes, but we see the indication that over geological time, the atmosphere has been transformed and much of it has been lost. We see something very different in methane from the C12 to C13 ratio. We see that the terrestrial reference is very close to the value that's measured. What this is telling us is that methane is being constantly resupplied to this atmosphere and keeping its isotopic ratio close to the terrestrial reference level. So the escape's not affecting the isotopic ratio for methane, but it does tell us one thing: that 50 million year time scale where methane is lost in the upper atmosphere is quite active, and methane is being resupplied in the upper atmosphere, continually resupplied to lead to the isotopic ratio that we actually measure. Okay, so that kind of goes through the escape process. Now,
question?
Yes.
Well, since these methane resupplies are similar to what you're seeing on Earth, if I understand what you said, why do you rule out the possibility of life being the source of this deep down inside the planet, where the water would be liquid?
Well, okay, I understand where you're going. You can't rule it out, but you've got two kind of conjectures there on top of each other that are a bit stretched. So the Occam's razor would attack those to some degree. I mean, we can explain the methane being present in the early primordial material, so we don't need life to necessarily explain methane being trapped in the interior. And we don't yet have any direct evidence that there's a liquid water ocean underneath the crust. If they're both, if there is a liquid water beneath the surface, the possibility exists that the methane is being resupplied by life. We don't presently think that is needed to explain the situation that we see. Does that clarify?
Yep, thanks.
Okay. So just to finish this discussion off a little bit, we also see another aspect of this. When the methane is destroyed in the upper atmosphere and forms these more complex organic molecules, the hydrogen is supposed to escape to space, and we can see that happening. And in slide 41, we show profiles of molecular hydrogen in the upper atmosphere, and we can see that the observed escape is depleting the density even more so than we would calculate from this mechanism called genes escape, which is a theoretical. So we're getting rid of methane at a very rapid rate, 3 times faster than we even anticipated in the upper atmosphere. So this conversion process, converting methane to higher order hydrocarbons that come back to the surface of the planet, is alive and well, and we can see direct evidence of that with a neutral mass spectrometer. Okay, now let's go on and talk about the formation of complex organic, because we're getting a little bit longer than I anticipated. Okay, so let's come back to this slide that I showed you before, in slide 43. We've got molecular nitrogen and methane in the upper atmosphere. We've got sunlight as a source of energy. Most importantly, we've got very ultraviolet wavelengths in the sunlight that provide very energetic photons, as well as energetic particles from the upper atmosphere of Saturn, both which are acting upon the molecular nitrogen methane to break it apart. When it's broken apart, it can either be broken apart or it can be ionized. When it breaks apart, I'll show you the chemical cycle in a minute, but it forms things like acetylene, ethylene, ethane, and hydrogen cyanide. These are the organic building blocks that are present that are formed by this initial process. Ionization also takes place, and this ionization seems to be important, at least the indications are, is important in putting together these building blocks to form these organic molecules. And part of that speculation comes about because we see this correspondence that's shown in the mass spectra in these two figures between what we see in the neutral spectrum in the lower panel and the ion spectrum in the upper panel. There's correspondences in those peaks, and as I said before, those peaks are 12 to 14 atomic mass units apart, so they're adding a carbon or adding a nitrogen each time around to form a more complex molecule. These smaller organic building blocks are being put together into more complex molecules by these processes. So if we go on to slide 43, actually 44, excuse me, this is just a repeat, so I think I'll skip past that one. It's the same information, just showing that both the neutral chemistry, which are neutral material, which is represented in the upper panel, and the ions in the lower panel are very complex. Okay, in slide 45, let's get into a little bit of detail on the chemistry itself, and let's concentrate for a minute on the part that's circle, where at this bottom panel, bottom portion of the panel that's marked methane, it's bottom left. Very important part of this process is the fact that ultraviolet light breaks apart the methane to form these radicals that are shown here, and these radicals then react with the nitrogen and with other methane to form more complex molecules. Same thing happens to the nitrogen in the upper panel. You can see that both sunlight, ultraviolet sunlight, and electrons act on molecular nitrogen, breaking it apart either into ions, these N2 plus or N plus or the ions, and the N quartets and so forth are different electronic states of the atomic nitrogen. When you make it molecular nitrogen into atomic nitrogen, you now have a very reactive species that can attack methane or other molecules in the upper atmosphere. Okay, going on to the next panel, this just shows you in a schematic way how some of that initial chemistry takes place. So I didn't put this in for complexity. I put it in to demonstrate the complexity, but not to force you to understand all the details of what's going on. But again, we're showing the nitrogen and the methane being broken apart and ionized and forming, well, the one that's shown in the center, C2H4, is the ethylene. And also, and an important constituent is the hydrogen cyanide that's being formed in the upper atmosphere. And then you can see these blocks are interacting with the ions, the C2H5+, and the H2CN+, and the CH3+, are ions that are formed in this process. So there's a very closely interwoven ion and neutral chemistry that's producing these organic compounds. So going on to slide 46, we just show some theoretical models how that evolves and how it changes in time at Titan. So let won't dwell on this, but we have measurements that we can compare to models to check this chemistry, and we're presently doing that. That's the importance of adding this slide in. And then in slide 48, I show how the second order processes take place, where you're forming more and more complex hydrocarbon species, which form the ethane, the acetylene. We start putting acetylene together to form the polymer, the C4H2, which can continue on, and we see the role of, again, the ions in this particular chemistry. Okay, so slide 49, let's just come back to, this one didn't, somehow the spectra got, is missing from this, Trina, when they reproduced it, or at least I can't see it.
This is on page 49.
There's something, well, anyway, it's not terribly important. Somehow it's, the PDF file is just showing the concentrations of species, at least in my portion of it, but there's a mass spectrum that goes with this, and this just shows that INMS has measured these neutrals, the methane, acetylene, ethane in the upper atmosphere, and they fit roughly with the models, but we're starting to try to understand the details of that, and we've measured propyne and propane as well, and those are indicated. So those are some indicative values. These are the mixing ratios. These are the number of, the first one is the number of molecules of methane, the percentage of them, not the percentage, excuse me, but the number relative to N2, which is the major constituent. Okay, so they're called mixing ratios. It's the number compared to the number of the total particles in a volume of the atmosphere. If we go on to 50, we just get into more and more complex hydrocarbons and how this whole process builds up. So I'm going to skip past this. I'm going to jump past 51, 52, which are just details of this chemistry, and go on to slide 54, where I want to talk a little, get on through some of the importance of the magnetosphere participating in this process. So in slide 55, there's an indication of the complexity of the interaction of Saturn's magnetosphere. There's charged particles in Saturn's magnetosphere that come from the outgassing of Enceladus, for instance, will produce water that gets ionized and picked up, and Titan itself is giving off material that it gets accelerated, and then we re-encounter it as Titan moves through the atmosphere. And the magnetic field, or the magnetosphere, is moving at near the co-rotational rate of Saturn, which is pretty rapid, relative to Titan, which is taking 16 days to go in its orbit around Saturn. So Titan is sitting still, and this magnetosphere is just moving, slamming into it at hundreds of kilometers per second. And those materials, those energetic particles, bombard the upper atmosphere and are part of this process that leads to escape and part of the process that leads to creating this very rich organic soup in the upper atmosphere. So it's not just solar radiation, it's particles from the magnetosphere that are doing this. And an indication of this is in slide 56, where we come back to the spectra I've shown you before, but this was on the outbound portion of the T5 flyby, the geometry shown to you. Here you can see the magnetospheric flow ramming in to the nose of Titan. And you can see that the sun, when we took this measurement, was behind the planet. So we were in the dark. We were completely in the dark. And these particles, these ions, only have lifetimes of a few hours. So there shouldn't have been any there if it wasn't for the fact that the magnetosphere is producing a very rich and abundant upper ionosphere that we see. And you can see the complexity of this ionosphere, and that's all coming about as a result of energetic particles, not as a result of sunlight. Okay? 57 just gives you an altitude profile, gives you altitude profiles of different constituents, but at least on my version of this, the labels got, oh no, finally pops up, takes a minute or two. You can see the different constituents that we've measured and how they change with altitude. Very rich, complex ionosphere. And I'm going to skip through a little bit of, in a fast way through some of this complex chemistry, but in 58, you see what what we thought was happening in the upper atmosphere from the ion chemistry point, ion neutral chemistry point of view, is illustrated in this Keller et al. Model flow chart. You can kind of follow through that and understand how the more complex compounds are being built up. But what we found out was that there were, when we looked at the mass spectrum in detail, there were several missing masses, and this indicates on slide 59 that some of those were at 18 and 30 and 42 and 50. So certain mass numbers were missing, were not explained by the model. And some of our group then came up with a new chemistry or some additions to that chemistry that showed the importance of nitrogen constituents in the upper atmosphere forming what we call nitrile compounds, carbon-nitrogen compounds in the upper atmosphere that are very important in this overall ion-neutral chemistry. And that's illustrated in slide 60, where some of these new species are identified. And in 61, that's how they modified the chemistry to account for the existence of these nitrile compounds. Okay, so in 62, we're going to just close up with talking about the ultimate fate of complex organics and try to do a bit of a summary, and then we'll be done and you can ask questions. Okay, so in slide 63, we have some species indicated. We have CH4, we have molecular nitrogen, we have acetylene, ethylene, ethane, and propane. And we've got the values that INMS has measured in the upper atmosphere. And then we have the measured values from the infrared measurements by the SEERs. Composite infrared spectrometer is what SEERs stands for, but that's measuring remotely what the values are in the stratosphere. And you can see that methane is about the same for the two because it's well mixed throughout the atmosphere and it has a fairly long lifetime. But all the rest of the, well, and hydrogen is falls into the same category. But if you look at the complex organics, you can see that ethylene, acetylene, all these more complex organics, in every case, the value of the mixing ratio, which is what is represented here, the number of particles relative to the total number of particles in a given volume of air, is much larger, several orders of magnitude larger in the upper atmosphere than it is in the lower and in the stratosphere. So this strongly suggests to us that it's the upper atmosphere that's the source of these organic compounds, and then they're diffusing back through the atmosphere, forming aerosols and being seen in the stratosphere as gases as well. But this is an important way of helping us establish that it's the upper atmosphere where this production is largely taking place. And if we go on to 64, just a reminder of the slide we saw before, which reiterates this point. Looking in the lower atmosphere, we can look at the composition of the aerosols. We can see these small aerosol particles start forming and precipitate. They eventually precipitate out onto the surface, and we can see this very complex organic chemistry persisting through the stratosphere. Finally, in 65, we see another radar picture of these dunes that I've told you about, which are made of organic material, and we're working very hard to establish the connection of these organic dunes with these aerosol particulates and the precipitation of these aerosol particulates from the atmosphere, from the stratosphere, back onto the surface. All right, so let's see, 66 is just acknowledgments, and so I'll stop there and entertain any further questions that you might have.
Are there any questions?
Mute off.
Yeah, this is Ken in North Carolina. I've got one. How do I explain to sixth graders the similarity in the nitrogen in Titan's atmosphere to the nitrogen in our atmosphere?
The molecule itself is exactly the same, okay? But it's going to be much colder there. You could tell them that it's colder than any place on Earth. But it's, and on the surface, the pressure is about, let's say, 30 to 40% higher than it would be on Earth. So it's, the pressure's a little bit higher than on Earth, but largely it's the same. There's you know, it's colder and it's more dense, but that's the only difference. Will that help?
Does it come from the same location?
A little bit. What I mostly want to know is, can we capture this for how we got the nitrogen here on Earth or on Titan?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, the nitrogen on Titan seems to come in as ammonia, and then through subsequent chemistry was turned into molecular nitrogen, photochemistry in the upper atmosphere. At least that's the way we think it happens now. We think similar processes must have occurred in the case of the Earth. Now, so it didn't come in as molecular nitrogen, because that's a very volatile compound. You have to get it to 77 degrees Kelvin, even colder than the surface of Titan, to freeze the stuff.
Right.
So,
but I guess the follow-up would be, why does it not happen on the other planetary bodies that have atmospheres?
Okay. Well, in all cases, we do see nitrogen. I mean, we see molecular nitrogen in Mars.
Right.
And to some degree, but not at the level. Much of Mars' atmosphere has escaped, so it's been tremendously modified by the escape process. And one of the strong indicators that escape has occurred is the nitrogen isotopic ratios on Mars. So much of the nitrogen escaped on Mars from the previous time period, where it was probably a denser atmosphere. And in the case of Venus, you got a very dense atmosphere, and most of it's CO2. Well, in the case of the Earth, there would be a lot of CO2 if it hadn't formed a bunch of rocks. Limestone sediments have, in the presence of liquid water, you can form limestone solid compounds, so the CO2 is precipitated out. And that's why the atmosphere of Venus is much more dense than the Earth. And the reason why Earth is different is that we have those CO2 compounds tied up in the rocks and the sediments and so forth.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, any other
questions? No other questions? Shocking. Well, I guess, Hunter, I have a question. What was sort of the biggest surprise that you've learned in the first, 17 or 18 Titan flybys? The thing that sort of strikes you as the thing that was most surprising?
The complexity of the organic chemistry in the upper atmosphere. We thought the organic chemistry throughout the atmosphere, the organic chemistry throughout the atmosphere would be of importance for determining the overall composition of the atmosphere. But we were surprised and happy to find that most of the action seems to be occurring up high in the atmosphere in terms of formation.
And what would you say you're looking forward to the most with the remaining Titan flybys? Just figuring it out?
Yes, and, you know, repeated spectra that keeps telling us the same things or telling us slightly different things at different latitudes are important part of putting the puzzle together. For instance, if we're going to determine the importance of the magnetosphere for producing these complex organics versus the importance of solar ultraviolet light, then we need to be looking in the dark, and we need to be looking in lighted regions of the atmosphere to sort out the relative importance of those two. That's a very important question to answer.
And finally, I guess I'll ask you one of the questions I asked Harry Soderblom last month. What is your predict for when you think the next mission to Titan will happen?
Well, I think that it's proving to be one of the most interesting bodies that we've ever visited in the solar system, and I would hope that within the next 50 years we go back. But I, you know, things move pretty slow.
Next 50? Oh.
Well, I mean, if you start planning now, you've got you got a travel time of 7 years, you got a build time of 7 years, and to get it together takes another few years. So 25 would be the fastest if we started today, probably.
Oh, man, I plan on retiring on the next mission to Titan.
Well, let's hope it's at a faster time scale than I think.
Do we have any other questions? Okay, well, I want to thank Dr. Wei today for joining us. We've really enjoyed the talk. Our October Charm Telecon will be on Halloween, October 31st, and we'll be joined by Roger Clark. He's a member of the VIMS team, that's a visual and infrared mapping spectrometer, and he'll be telling us a bit about the icy satellites of Saturn and what are some of the surface compositions that he's been able to figure out from his data sets. And we expect a fantastic talk there. We don't have our November talk lined up, although we're beating the bushes. And, of course, we don't have a Charm Telecon in December. And with that, we'll let everybody go. Have a great week.
Trina, well, let me just add one thing. If people do want to come up with questions later that they want to ask me, they're welcome to send me an email. And do they know my email?
If they don't know your email, they're welcome to send an email to the Charm Leads, and we will forward it on. Again, the Charm Leads is charm_leads_01@cdsa.jpl.nasa.gov.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Hunter.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.